A quick note for anyone just tuning in. You've landed in the middle of a special six-part season of BioPodcast. We've been following four biographers for the last 8 months of 2025. All the doubt and determination that goes into writing someone else's life story. If you haven't heard the earlier episodes, they're right there in the feed. Start at episode one and then come back. We'll wait. Okay, on to the show.
I still feel like I wish that next year's Katie Rose could talk to me now and give me any sort of insight on how this is all going to go. I don't know.
Katie Rose Quant is a journalist, a mother of three, and aspiring biographer. And there, she's wishing her future self could send a message back. I'm Jenny Skoog. This is Four Paths, One Impossible Dream. So far this season, we've talked about the work, the business, and the ideas. But there's something we haven't talked about yet, and it might be the most important thing. What it actually feels like. The loneliness and the doubt. The people who keep you going. And what happens when you start to wonder if any of it is worth it. This is episode 5, Community and Solitude. I asked Sarah Benincasa who keeps her going. She didn't start with her editor. She didn't even start with her agent. She started with her therapist.
My support system would be my romantic partner, who does not dwell with me, but dwells not far away, and is the reason I moved to Chicago. And so he's been great. My therapist, who I've been working with for many years now. I'm sober, so I have a sober community of friends who help me.
A partner, a therapist, and a sober community are Sarah's inner circle. But when it comes to the book itself, the obsessive, granular, endless details of Abraham Lincoln's life, Sarah's options narrow fast.
There are not many close friends who can completely relate, but they can relate in different ways. Some of them would be, I think, rather bored talking about the subject matter, but there are a few who are kind enough to let me info dump and just get it out. And I would say, you know, my parents, my brother and sister-in-law, they're very enthusiastic, supportive, can always bring me back down to earth, you know. And my editor is great. Like, it's really nice to know that I can reach out and just say, hey, what do you think? I appreciate that.
See, that's what biographical friendship looks like. You find the three people who let you talk for 40 minutes about types of wood in Kentucky, and you hold on to them for dear life. Sarah had also figured out something about the physical toll of writing a book. This is her fifth, but it felt like her first.
It's funny, this is my fifth book, but it has in many ways been an exercise in relearning how to write. It's been back to the fundamentals.
Every book strips you down. Each book makes you feel like a beginner again. And Sarah's advice to first-time authors had gotten very specific.
Over the years, when I've spoken to first-time authors who ask for advice, usually they're memoirists, I always say, get a therapist. And now I say, get a therapist and some kind of movement practice. I am not an athlete, but taking a walk saves my life.
Get a therapist and take a walk. That's it. That's the advice. Sarah didn't say it directly, but I heard it anyway. Writing biography is an act of sustained intimacy with someone who can't talk back. You spend years inside of another person's life, their letters, their choices, and their failures. Then you close the laptop and you're alone in a room in Chicago. The gap between those two worlds, Lincoln's world and Sarah's world, is where the loneliness lives. Sarah found a way through it. She calls it Lincoln time. She lights a candle and gets to work. The work is solitary, and no amount of support changes that. Kate Culkin told me something that surprised me. She had submitted her manuscript to peer review deliberately long, hoping the reviewers would tell her where to cut.
When it came back from peer review, the peer reviews were positive, but I had already sent it in a little longer than it was supposed to be with the idea that I would get feedback about where to cut, and instead I just got suggestions to add things.
It's either the best compliment a scholar can get or a nightmare, depending on your deadline. So Kate had to cut her darlings on her own. But there were things that she still wished she'd kept.
there are some things I cut that I wish were in there because they were just things that I liked. I don't know if they would have made, I don't think they necessarily made the book any better, but like the sisters get in this fight about politics. I think it's around the 1870, I think it's the 1880 election. And I figured out that the Forbes were supporting a Democratic candidate, which, you know, at the time in the North was kind of amazing. And I went on this deep dive and I figured out why, and I figured out how Edith's father-in-law was involved in that election. And it was really an interesting story, but to tell it in a way that made sense, I was going to have to really go off on this tangent about this election. And I just was like, either the story is just not complete or detract too much, and really it's not about the sisters. So I do kind of wish it was in there. But I was like, well, I guess I could tell that that could be an independent, they could be articles.
Kate had done the research, cracked the puzzle, found the father-in-law connection, and then cut all of it. Because biography is about choices, not just what to include, but what to let go of. Kate had also found community in an unexpected place, Concord itself. The town that was home to her subjects had embraced her.
One thing that's probably unique about, maybe not unique about this book, but it is a situation about this book, is that Concord, Massachusetts, where Ellen and Edith grew up, you know, they're with their famous father and very intriguing mother, has a big history tourism culture. Because you have Ralph Emerson's house, basically across the street, you have Louisa May Alcott's house, which is a huge tourist magnet, and you have Wayside, which is where the Alcotts lived there first, and then the Hawthorns lived there, and that's occasionally open. And then you have the battleground from the Battle of Concord from 1775, which is obviously this year is getting a huge amount of attention because it's the 250th anniversary. And you have Walden Pond, where there is a recreation of Thoreau's cabin, and that's actually on land that the Emersons owned, and then Edith actually donated it, you know, for public use. And then there's Thoreau's birthplace, Thoreau Farm. So there's lots of sites in Concord that are interested in this project. There are not that many sites outside of Concord that are interested in having me come speak. And so I found everyone in Concord, that whole community has been incredibly supportive of this project. But I found like I sort of had to navigate like where I'm going to speak. I don't want to insult people who've been supportive of me. And I don't think I at first realized like how complicated some of these situations are. It's a very supportive community and they are also competing for resources, you know. And so the first people to ask me to speak was the Concord Free Public Library, the special collections there. And I also felt a huge loyalty to them because those collections were so important to me. Even though they didn't have the sisters' letters, they had their brother Edward's letters and lots of other material that was really useful. They were just incredibly generous throughout the process. They didn't charge me for any of the pictures I used in the book. You know, sometimes that's a huge expense for particularly like academic authors who don't have a big press behind them.
The Concord Free Public Library, whose special collections had been essential to her research, the Emerson House, the Thoreau Society, they all wanted Kate, but they also wanted to be the ones who got her. Kate had to figure out the politics of Concord itself while writing about the politics of the Emerson family. Layers upon layers. And there was one more community, the one that runs quietest. Other biographers. Kate teaches in the CUNY Biography and Memoir Program. She's around people who understand the work. But even within that community, there's a limit to how much anyone wants to hear about the Emerson sisters. The truth is, writing biography is communal in theory and solitary in practice. You belong to a community of people who do the same kind of work. But the actual hours, the reading, the writing, the deciding what to cut, those happen alone. Kevin McRuder once described himself in a way that gave me pause.
Yeah, I already thought I was doing, you know, kind of a living the double life, community development lender during the day, reading Harlem Renaissance, writing at night.
And Kevin realized that was exactly Fisher's story too, a radiologist by day, a novelist by night. Kevin had received Bio's Francis Frank Rollin Fellowship, a grant from Biographers International that helped fund his research travel. The $5,000 award goes to an author working on a biographical work about an African-American figure whose story provides a significant contribution to our understanding of the Black experience. The fellowship aims to remediate the disproportionate scarcity and even suppression of Black lives and voices in the broad catalog of published biography.
His manuscripts, almost all of them are at Brown, and I've looked at those, and I'll go back probably this summer. The Rollin Fellow from Bio, I definitely appreciate that. I probably would have done the traveling anyway, but that definitely made it less of a financial burden.
See, that's the thing about Kevin. The fellowship helped, but the work was going to happen regardless. What Kevin didn't talk about much, what I had to piece together from scattered comments across 8 months of interviews, was the emotional weight of the competition. In episode 4, you heard Kevin describe finding out that somebody else was writing about Fisher. He'd been generous. He shared his research, the death certificate findings, and then the other writer published an article in American Scholar that was only about Fisher. Kevin laughed when he told me, but here's what he said next.
Before we started recording, you mentioned the drama of biography. So
Yes.
I was feeling that.
That is drama.
That's some of it. So we'll see.
You just have to be the first one to.
That's my goal. So that's why I can't let these other projects hold me.
Yeah. Away. No, there's a sense of urgency now. I can't let these other projects pull me. Kevin has too many things competing for his time, teaching, other writing projects, the community development work. And now, for the first time, there's a reason to hurry. Someone else is in the race. Kevin has something the competitor doesn't. He met Jane Ryder Fisher, Rudolph's wife, in the early 90s. He sat with her. He heard her talk about the evenings at their home, the artists and musicians who passed through. She told him about their friendship with Carl Van Vechten.
Rudolph Fisher he and his wife, Jane Ryder Fisher, were very good friends with Carl Van Vechten. And I remember Mrs. Fisher, when I interviewed her in the 90s, she'd said that they were there all the time. And she said, you know, at any given evening, there might be George Gershwin, Alfred Knopf. And it was just, even though I knew that, kind of looking at it through the lens of the friendship he had with Locke, reinforced that, no, he wasn't on the outside, that he was part of that circle.
Kevin heard that from Fisher's wife. That's not something you find in an archive. That's oral history, fragile, irreplaceable, and now Kevin's to tell. So I asked Katie Rose if she'd ever thought about quitting. There was a pause. Then...
It's more of my fear that I'll just never sell it, or like somehow will fail to make it happen, less so that I'll quit. I think I'm just too invested at this point. I want this book to exist, and that's a pretty motivating factor. Like I really still believe in the project, and I'm still kind of endlessly fascinated by my subjects, and so I don't want to quit. I haven't considered that.
She hasn't considered quitting, not because the path is clear. It isn't. Not because she's confident. She's getting there, but she's not there yet. She hasn't considered quitting because she wants this book to exist. That's it. That's the whole reason. Katie Rose had put her proposal through a writing circle, a group of fellow writers who read it cold and gave feedback.
One of the things I really wanted feedback on was this sort of, I don't know, 7-page maybe overview, which is really hard when you've done so much research and so much writing and written all these chapter summaries, and I've written papers on this for school and sample chapters, and then trying to kind of consolidate this complicated idea. There was some really good feedback. I mean, one that comes to mind is people were suggesting I kind of bring some scenes forward a little bit, because I have done some of that writing, and it wasn't really in that. It wasn't maybe shining that I do have maybe some of these scenes and quotes and details that will really make it come alive. So trying to like help me figure out which parts to really elevate, bring to the top of an overview like that was really helpful. It was also helpful to get just a group of people's thoughts on like reading it cold. Was there anything that needed more explaining that I was like assuming my readers knew, or were there things that just could use a little bit more explanation or bringing to the forefront, kind of stuff like that. It wasn't really a major structural overhaul, but I found it really helpful. I've used this same kind of overview for a few fellowship applications, and it's kind of just evolved over like the last couple of years as I've been doing this research. And I really think that this particular feedback probably, in my opinion, is helping it shine a little bit better. So I'm glad to have that kind of opportunity before I put this in front of anyone who I'm hoping wants to rep this book.
You've been living with these five women for years. You know everything about them. And then someone reads your 7-page overview and says, "Wait, who's Julia Lathorp?" You've forgotten what other people don't know. When I asked Katie Rose if she felt more confident than she did in April, she gave me the most honest answer of the entire series.
I think maybe I feel a little bit more confident now.
A little bit more confident, maybe, she thinks. I love this answer because it's so carefully hedged. Not, "I'm confident," not, "I believe in myself." Just a little bit more, maybe. And the infrastructure holding her up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would just say that I have like one of my benefits here is that I do have like an incredibly supportive family when it comes to my writing and my career. And I'm like just financially lucky that I'm married to someone who's not a writer. There's a little bit more stability or, traditional like 9 to 5 work going on in our household. But my husband's so supportive. My parents like want this book to happen more than I do.
Oh boy, that got me. Her whole family pulling for a book that doesn't have an agent or a publisher or a deal, just a belief that it should exist.
Yeah, and having kids has like made it more challenging. But I sort of just deep down, like I'm a pretty determined person, and I want to make the book happen. But I also just don't want to have to choose between parenting and writing a book. And so I'm like kind of very motivated to make it work for me.
She doesn't want to choose between parenting and writing, between her journalism career and her book, between being present for her three kids and spending years in the archives of Jane Addams and Alice Hamilton. Katie Rose isn't asking for permission. She's not asking anyone to solve it for her. She's just refusing to accept that the choice is binary. Well, here's what I've learned making this series. The loneliness is the job. You can have a partner who loves you, a therapist who keeps you sane, a sober community that holds you up, a family that wants your book to happen more than you do, a whole New England town that shows up for your events. And the work is still you, alone with a dead person's letters. Sarah takes walks. Kate cuts stories that she loves. Kevin races a competitor that he helped. Katie Rose refuses to choose. Nobody warned them that it would feel like this. Or maybe they were warned and they did it anyway. Next time, the season finale, January 2026. Where they stand, what's changed and what hasn't, and the question that started this whole thing, who gets to write biography, finally gets an answer. Four Paths, One Impossible Dream is a production of BioPodcast and Biographers International Organization. Ellie and Marie Fillengains created our theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Cherie Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Skoog. Special thanks to Sarah Benincasa, Kate Culkin, Kevin McGruder, and Katie Rose Quant for letting me into their lives and their work. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org.